Mary Poppins is a classic movie about life in 19th century London. One of the characters is a prim and proper banker who brings his son to the bank one day, and because of his son's misconduct, the dad is summoned before the owners of the bank. It is an awful, wonderful day when he decides that he's going to change his lifestyle, and from that moment on, he's going to start to enjoy life.
No, not that, steady on. Well, do you have anything to say, Banks?
Well, sir, they do say that when there's nothing to say, all you can say...
Confound it, Banks, I said, do you have anything to say?
Just one word, sir.
Yes?
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
What?
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Mary Poppins was right. It's extraordinary. It does make you feel better.
What are you talking about, man? There's no such word.
Oh, yes, it is a word. A perfectly good word. Actually, do you know what there's no such thing as? It turns out, with due respect, when all is said and done, that there's no such thing as you.
Impertinent, sir.
Speaking of impertinence, would you like to hear a perfectly marvelous joke? A real snapper.
Joke? Snapper?
Yes. There are these two wonderful young people, Jane and Michael, and they meet one day on the street, and Jane says to Michael, I know a man with a wooden leg named Smith. And Michael says, really? What's the name of his other leg?
The man's gone mad. Call the guard.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. I'm feeling better all the time.
Banks, don't you dare strike my father.
There's the tuppence. The wonderful, fateful, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious tuppence. Guard it well. Goodbye.
Banks, where are you going?
I don't know. I might pop through a chalk pavement picture and go for an outing in the country, or I might seize a horse off a merry-go-round and win the derby, or I might just fly a kite. Only Poppins would know.
Poppins?
My nanny. She's the one who sings that ridiculous song.
A spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down, the medicine go down, the medicine go down.
That's what we all want to do. We want to enjoy life. Now, it may come as something of a surprise that that is exactly what God wants us to do. When God created humankind, he plotted into the motherboard of humanity a desire for enjoyment, which would be a cruel thing if God had not also provided the means, the resources for us to enjoy life. Listen to the summary of creation that is written into the first chapter of the Bible. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food, and to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has life and breath in it. I give every green plant for food, and it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. So God designed a world for enjoyment, with personal relationships, with marriage and sex and family, with fish and birds and plants and food and more. And then God stepped back and he looked at what he had done. And he said that it was very good. He designed his human creatures for enjoyment and he provided all of the resources necessary for that enjoyment to be fulfilled. You know, if you are a musician who performs well, if you are an artist who draws a masterpiece, if you are a poet who writes a good poem, or you are simply good at giving a back rub and you help somebody else out by relieving some of their back pain, after it's finished, the person who benefited says, "Thank you." And you say, "I'm glad you enjoyed it." That's what we say to God for all of the resources that He has provided for us, all of the good, all of the blessings in our lives. We say, "Thank you." And God says, "I'm glad. I'm glad that you enjoyed it." Because God designed us to enjoy all that He has provided. However, there are experiences in life that are deeply troublesome. And the troubles of life can steal the enjoyment of life. Jesus is the one who said, "I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." That is, that Jesus left heaven and came to earth, and His purpose was to follow up on what God had done in creation. That the purposes of God be fulfilled, and that includes our enjoyment of life to the full. But Jesus also said, in this world, you will have trouble. That troubles are an inevitable part of our lives. And strange as it may seem, until we figure that out, we're never going to enjoy life. Until we understand that troubles are part of the fabric of life and figure out how to deal with them, we are not going to be able to enjoy life as God intended for life to be enjoyed. Now, I'll tell you what we do. We see the troubles of life, and then we work very hard to eliminate those troubles. We exercise, we eat the right food, we take medicines, we save money, we buy insurance, we protect ourselves from poverty, we do everything to protect our children from the difficulties of life. We do the things that we can best do to minimize life's problems. If there are people that we think will reduce life's problems, we try to bring them in closer. If there are people that we think cause troubles in our lives, we do everything we can, sometimes to the point of engaging the law to accomplish it, to keep them at a distance. We convince ourselves if we work hard enough and long enough, then we can get over the troubles of life, and then we'll be home free. And then we can coast for a while. We think that next year is going to be better. At last, the problems will be behind us. We assume that if we work hard to a retirement day, that starting at retirement, at last we can enjoy life in a way that was never before possible. Now, all of this is commendable. It's fine. As long as we understand that there is nothing that we can do to eliminate the troubles of life. That you can eat the best diet and still get sick. You can be a terrific athlete with your body in great shape and you can still get hurt. That you can be a billionaire and the market reverses can leave you bankrupt. That you can be a fabulous parent and raise your children in the best way possible and they can still not turn out to fulfill your dreams. That we will never escape the troubles of life. That around the corner next year or on retirement day, there will be troubles that are there waiting for us. And you say, "Oh, well, this is a terribly bleak way to be talking about how we're supposed to enjoy life." But unless we understand how to deal with the troubles, we are never going to enjoy life as we are supposed to. So how do we do it? How do we get the combination together that God designed us to enjoy life, provided the resources, and sin has brought troubles into our world? How do we fit it all together? There are three powerful concepts. One is contentment. A second is delight. And a third is joy. Contentment. Advertisers tell us that a typical American is exposed to 3,000 different ads per day. Assume that that's over about a 17-hour period, unless you sell advertising time in your dreams, and that means that you're exposed to three or more ads per minute. And basic to advertising strategy is to create dissatisfaction and discontentment. So you drove home in your car that runs just fine, it's paid for, it's good transportation, and you're pretty happy with it. You enjoyed the ride home. You come in, you turn on the television, and you see either a new model of that car or a different model that has seven more cup holders than your current car has. And immediately you're discontent and you are willing to go out and incur significant monthly payments in order to get contentment, in order to have your expectations met. And this happens over and over to the point that there are so many expectations that we have created for us and that we buy into that even if we had unlimited resources, complete wealth, we would not have enough life in time to buy all of the things, to meet all of the expectations that we have. So we're discontent. We don't enjoy the things that we have in life. I'm one of those people who kind of thinks that other generations face pretty much the same stuff that we face. But maybe this is an exception, because discontent is epidemic within our generation. Advertising is part of it, but there are other reasons. We have had so many wonderful accomplishments, let's say in medicine. We live so much longer than people did 100 years ago, and we have healthier lives in doing it. And what that has done is left us not all that grateful for longer life and good health, but raised our expectations that we live longer still and that we be in excellent health during all of the years that we have. The same thing has happened with marriage. We have idealized marriage to the point that we think that there shouldn't be any troubles in marriage, and when there are, then we are tempted to abandon that relationship. So it's kind of ironic. We live in this time of great prosperity and long life expectancy and wonderful resources, and we are less happy about it than we would have otherwise been. It is discontent. The way to become content is to align expectations and circumstances. And we try to do that. And so we work hard, we buy things, we change things in order to have our expectations met. But there's another way. The other way is to change our expectations to match our circumstances. And that is powerfully transforming. There are those who change their expectations about the car they drive, the job they work, the marriage relationship they have, the bodies that they live in, and suddenly have a 100% increase in contentment and enjoy life in a way that seemed previously impossible. It was St. Paul who wrote to the Philippians, "I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want." This guy is saying, when I'm hungry, I can be content with that. When I'm stuffed, I can be content with that. When I'm poor, I can be content. When I have a lot of money, I can still be content. Whatever the circumstances, I have learned. Isn't that an interesting choice of words? I've learned it. So he implies that he was a malcontent. There was a time in his life when there was a misalignment of expectations and circumstances. And he was an unhappy guy. He didn't enjoy life. And so he set out on a learning curve to alter his expectations. And he did it to the point where he aligned expectations and circumstances and became a content man, regardless of what those circumstances may be. That is a powerful truth. And that will work pretty much for anybody. You don't have to read the Bible. You don't have to believe in God. You don't have to be a follower of Jesus Christ. If you change expectations to match circumstances, you will experience contentment and life will be a whole lot more enjoyable. But there is something that is available to Christians, readers of the Bible, and believers in God that others don't have. It is described in Psalm 37:4. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. I remember when I read this and came to a face value understanding of it. Here's what I understood it to mean. If you like God, he'll give you everything you want, which seemed like a good deal to me. So I decided I like God. I think he's nice. So therefore, he has obligated himself to give to me everything I ever want in life. And one day I had my thinking transformed. I remember the day. I remember the room. I remember where I was in the room. I remember the person who spoke just a few sentences that I am sure she has forgotten for a very long time, but it was transforming for me. I was a seminary student. I was a part-time youth pastor in a church, and I was given the assignment of teaching the college-age class, which was a fairly light assignment because it was a small church without any college students. So I spent no time in preparation. However, summer came around, and there were a few people that had grown up in the church who had gone off to school, and in the summertime, I actually did teach the class. And it was this student who was a sophomore at a university in Southern California. And she quoted this verse. I don't even think it was part of the lesson that day. She just quoted it, And she said, here's what I understand it to mean. That if we will delight in God, he will cause our hearts to desire what he wants them to desire. He will give us the desires that are in our hearts. Well, that's a completely different meaning than I had seen there. And I remember thinking to myself, so why didn't I think of this? I mean, I was the pastor or in training, I mean, almost the pastor, and she was, for crying out loud, she was just a sophomore. I mean, what do sophomores know? And she knew a whole lot more than I did. She had a perspective that was far better than mine. She got it right. What if the desires of our hearts were totally changed? So that we desired the right things and then God gave us the fulfillment of those desires. Then life would be completely different. This is not only the best way to truly enjoy life, this is the only way to truly enjoy life. To make our hearts desire God, to love him and pursue him and please him. And then when we delight in him, he will cause us to desire that which is good and right. Jesus said it in a different way. He said, seek first God's kingdom and God's righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. The context of Jesus' words in Matthew 6 has to do with food and beverage and clothes and getting over the worries of life. We seek first God's kingdom, and then God will take care of the rest. That we make God the priority of life. You know, we often talk about our priorities. Some of us have 12 priorities that rule our lives. Others of us have 40 priorities, or some have 82 priorities in life. Etymologists, those who study the history of language, tell us that it is only in recently comparative modern times that the word has become a plural noun, whereas in earlier literature, it was always singular, always priority, never priorities. That you can only have one priority in life. That is, whatever is first and overarches and controls absolutely everything else. The psalmist is saying in Psalm 37, and Jesus is saying in Matthew 6, that the priority of life is to delight in God, to seek him first. What would that look like? Well, we'd think a lot about God. We would love God. We would consider God in every detail of our lives. He would be more important than time or money or health, more important than friendships or business deals or vacations or luxuries. Not that those things don't matter. They do matter. But they're all subsets of the priority. But it's more than just thinking about God. It's delighting in God. We get that. You know those in whom you delight. Those are the people that when they walk into your room, they light up the room. This is the child that you are so proud of, the parent whom you adore and admire. This is the athlete or the musician or the athletic team that has you counted as a great fan. You delight in God. That is that you are thrilled with who he is. You are fascinated by what he says. You are enthralled by every word that he commands us to do. You see his hand in everything that's going on. And the more you see him in everything, the more you see him in everything. And when we delight in God, he changes the desires of our hearts. And we enjoy life. We all know people who don't enjoy life. For them, life is a bummer. These are the people who say, I hate my job, just hate it. And I don't like the place where I live. You know, it's really boring and disgusting. And I've pretty much fallen out of love with the person that I married. I don't know why I ever got into that relationship in the first place. And the weather, you know, we have lousy weather. I mean, really, a lot of lousy weather if you think about it. And then this person has a paradigm shift, has a faith transformation. Then the same person delights in God, and God gives to her or him the desires of the heart. And you're talking to this person who says, oh, you know, I just love my work. I love my job. And you say, oh, you have a new job? Oh, no, I've been there 10 years now. Really? Wow. And you know, I just live in the coolest place. I mean, it is just great. I just thoroughly enjoy going home. It is my haven in the midst of a busy world. And you know, I don't know if I told you this. I've fallen in love all over again. I've fallen in love with the person I've been married to all these years. And the have you noticed the weather? We've had 365 days of continuously good weather. Isn't that unusual? I mean, does that typically happen? But, you know, I've been counting the days. It's just absolutely marvelous. And you discover that here is this person who delights in the Lord and has had the desires of the heart changed and fulfilled. And this is someone who has now come to truly enjoy life. Contentment, delight, and joy. Joy in difficulty. For the greatest opportunity to live out these teachings of the Bible is not in the easy parts of life, but in the hardest parts of life. And if we cannot find joy in the hardest parts of life, we are not ever going to truly enjoy life. What we need is a joy that is for all seasons, designed to celebrate the best, but also strong enough to survive the worst. What if we could have a joy that lasted even through the greatest difficulties of life? Listen, nobody's suggesting that we want to be happy or seek after pain and misery, problems and difficulties and disasters, but that it is somehow possible to have joy even in these difficulties. Jesus' brother, James, wrote, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance." In other words, he's saying that you can go through the severe difficulties of life and still have pure joy at the same time. How does that happen? We received an out-of-state telephone call to our home this past week from a dad of an adult son who was sharing with us some difficult news about his son, who's probably in his mid to late 30s. He's a son who has made some poor choices in life and faced his share of problems and difficulties. A son who has had too many prodigal years, distanced from God, and therefore heavy on his parents' heart. So for the better part of 4 decades, they have prayed for their son to come into a right relationship with God and for his life to be what God wants his life to be. But he's not felt well over recent months. Tried a lot of different medical remedies. Thought they had it, but just a few days ago, he had an MRI that shows a large mass on one of his lungs. He's going to have a biopsy on Tuesday. And they've said it is probably one of several things and have given him a list. And I'll just tell you, you don't ever want anything that's on that list. Because even the best on the list isn't very good. So this is a heavy time. You know, no parent should ever lose a child, young or old. It's about as bad as things can get. And then this dad in this conversation went on with joy in his voice to talk about what has been happening in his son's life. That his son's relationship to God has been transformed. That he has come close to Jesus Christ in a way that maybe never he has known before. That he has a peace and a contentment that even has his father flabbergasted as he witnesses what his boy is going through. It's both at the same time. In the same sentences, in the same paragraph, with fluctuating tone of voice, he talks about this great difficulty and this supernatural joy. James says, consider it pure joy whenever you face trials of many kinds. I gotta tell you, I'm fascinated by the stories I hear from persons who are going through or have gone through great trauma. These are people that have been in horrific car accidents, who have been assaulted, who are cancer survivors, or have a prognosis that has actually been assigned the number of days they have left to live. And they talk about how different life now is. These are people, you've maybe talked to them yourself, or certainly have heard the stories secondhand or witnessed them on a television report. They say that they've never seen the sky so blue and the grass is so green, it just sort of stands out, and they are enthralled by the color of the flowers, and the birds have such melodic songs that they sing, and life is just amazing and wonderful, and they're so precious in their relationship to their family, and connected to God in ways that escape human description, and that they're thoroughly enjoying life. And every time I hear this, in my head I think, can't this be done without the accident? Can't you get there without the disease? Do you have to have a number for how many days you have left to live before you can truly come to that kind of peace and contentment and thorough enjoyment of life? And the answer is yes. Yes, that's exactly what God had in mind. That's precisely what God wants. He wants us to choose to enjoy life, to choose to align expectations with circumstances and to be content, to choose to delight in God and let Him shape and fulfill the desires of life, to choose to live the joy of Jesus Christ even in the middle of difficulty. St. Paul said it well. He said, "Rejoice in the Lord always." And then he was redundant. He said, "I'll say it again. Rejoice. Enjoy life. Live it to the full." That's what Jesus said. Experience everything that God has designed us for. Rejoice. I'll say it again. Rejoice. God, creator, designer of us, who knows us better than anyone, even ourselves. Lord, give to us the enjoyment of life that you have designed for us to experience. Protect us from the sins and troubles of life, that we may be and do all you want us to be and do, that we may know the joy that you desire.